I'll call the meeting to order.
And Representative Murphy has carefully read the minutes. Any discussion of the minutes? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? We've approved the minutes. Yes. Oh, there you go. And members, we're going to start with House File 55. Hopefully we can get it done in about 30 minutes. And for those of you that are new, things that are likely to be incorporated into the omnibus health care and human services bill are heard all during the the year up to the deadline times, and then they're heard but laid on the table for possible inclusion in the bill. If there are people that wish to testify in this bill but are not on the agenda, would they notify one of our pages? And with that, Representative Erickson.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to move House File 55 to be before the committee, and probably the A1 amendment along with it, so it's in the form in which Representative Swiggum would like it.
A1 amendment, Mr. Chairman, it's just a technical.
Representative Erickson has moved House File 55, and then she moved to amend it with the A1 amendment. Any discussion of that amendment? All those in favor signify by saying aye.
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 Representative Swiggum.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Mr. Chairman and members, it's been 8 years since I've had a chance to offer a bill before a committee, and I'm glad I get the opportunity to do it in your committee first. So thank you for the time.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, I appreciate yours and the committee's look at this bill, at least the focus, the direction of this bill as you consider your inclusion for the Omnibus Health and Human Service Bill later in this legislative session, and certainly would give you great encouragement to doing this bill or a form of this bill as you look forward to inclusion a couple of months from now and bringing forward that Omnibus Health and Human Service Bill. Mr. Chairman, the bill is pretty simple, fairly costly, fairly equitable, brings what I would say fairness to all areas of the state of Minnesota, and I would say, members, from my humble position, that for the chronologically gifted and for the caregivers of the chronologically gifted and throughout the state, it's probably the most important thing that we could do this legislative session from the standpoint of fairness and equity. Mr. Chairman, let me give you about 5 minutes of background from my perspective and why the bill is introduced. I know a couple of associations are here that might want to just say a word, and there's a number of nursing home administrators who, given the time, have want to say a word of support or at least give their perspective to the bill and why it's necessary and needed. Mr. Chairman, you and I have been here for, but first of all, the bill, very, very simple. The bill basically increases nursing home facility operating rates, the payment rates, to the geographic group 3 median. We basically have three groups, geographic groups in Minnesota. For nursing homes. Why we did it and the way we did it and how it was done, either from a policy or political standpoint, very, very hard to understand. It's hard to understand why Kuching in Cook County would be in geographic group 3, why Kitson would be in geographic group 2, and by Wilmer, Minnesota would be in geographic group 1. It's very hard to understand why those things took place and who made those decisions and why the decisions were made, but certainly it brings a great deal of unfairness, a great deal of inequity to the care for our chronologically gifted and their service around the state of Minnesota. There's many facilities in the state that if you threw a baseball from their facility and you threw a baseball either across a county line or across a river that goes into another county, that their reimbursement would be significantly different than it is, even though their market situation for nursing personnel, for RNAs, for caregivers, for food, for whatever is no different, their reimbursements would be significantly different. Again, the bill takes every nursing home in the state to geographic category 3, the median level, the median rate reimbursement for the operating rates. When I first started in the legislature way back in 1979, we had what was called Rule 49, kind of a cost-based reimbursement system. Didn't go so well, so we got rid of it. 85, we started Rule 50. I think, Mr. Chairman, you remember maybe Rule 50. Maybe you don't remember Rule 50, but we went from 49 to 50, Rule 50. 50 didn't work. It was prospective, but it was also determined on some of the three basic geographic rates that we have right now that have changed a little bit, by the way. In 95, we went to the alternative payment system. In 99, we allowed DHS to adjust some operating payments for all facilities in the state based upon specifics in law. But the disparity still essentially existed as a result of differences previous. And now we have the RUGs, the Resource Utilization Groups, of which there's all residents in our nursing homes are based into these 34 different RUG groups, and each has a different weight, each has a different reimbursement. As we look to the future as well, and I think this is something that we need to look in the future as to what's fair for all and how we get the best performance for how we spend taxpayer dollars. You know, the state has had some interest, and certainly Governor Plenty, in paying for performance in many, many different areas. And we've talked about the possibility of paying for performance in nursing homes. But as the associations in the industry, the various homes will tell you, it's very, very difficult to go to a pay-for-performance model until you start from an equitable, even ground for all those facilities that are out there that care for the elderly in their homes. So if we look into the future of going to some type of a pay-for-performance model, having some equity, having some fairness, some level of ground in the payment of the reimbursements would be very, very important. Now, in all fairness, we have made some small steps to close the great disparity that exists in the reimbursements over the past years. We've either done it maybe on a specific geographic area. Last year, a couple of years ago, we included the counties of Stearns and Sherburne in a little higher rate reimbursement, Benton too, I think. Back in 2001, 2002, we actually staged in some reduction of the disparities that existed statewide. And we took provided rate increases to the low rate facilities up to a benchmark, and this was for metro and non-metro facilities that was subject to a 10% increase for years 2001, 2002. So we have narrowed the gap somewhat, and when we've tried to address this question of equity and disparity somewhat, we've made a step in the right direction, and Oliver Wendell Holmes would tell you that it's not so important where you stand as the direction in which you're going. We made a step in the right direction. We need to finish the job. And this bill that you have before us would finish the job. Now, there's many different ways you can do it, but I think from the standpoint of equity, fairness to all areas of the state, and again to all the residents, would be very, very important. There is a physical cost to the bill, members. You need to be aware of the fact as you put your omnibus bill together. The physical cost of this bill the first year would be $22 million. The second year and years after would be about $33 million. The first year, $22 million, just because it doesn't start enactment until October of the fiscal year as opposed to July. So there is a significant cost, but it does put us in a position of equity, fairness, for all homes around the state. I think it's a pretty important direction to go, and it puts us in a position where we can say that RUG waiting person, the waiting factor of a one in Worthington, that we think that she is just as important of care and service and equity in that care and service as from Worthington to Rochester to Minneapolis to Duluth. And I think the fairness speaks for itself. And, Mr. Chairman, thank you for the time. I don't know if the council would like to add anything, John or Randy, to what I have stated, but I do know that there are others that will be willing to testify, and I'm certainly willing to take any questions.
Mr. Chun, did you have some comments, or did the...
No, Mr. Chair.
Representative Swigum did a fine job.
Thank you.
And John Walls?
No. Just I did what Randy Chun told me to do. I do not pretend to be near as wise as that individual.
Well, Representative Swigum, you mean you didn't remember all that, really?
To Representative Swigum from Randy Chun.
Okay, Representative Abler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and Representative Swigum. Somebody's got to quit while you're ahead. So anyway, actually, it's good to have you here talking about this problem. We've struggled with this for a good long time, and all my 9 years in this committee, we've talked about that. And just to remind members, and on behalf of your efforts, the House has historically led the way in trying to get better increases to these very groups, prisoners of history, and so on. I think as a bipartisan effort, the House has been leading this work. So we're still going the right direction. We were told by the department a couple days ago that that they understand that the 2% may be a little lean and the 1.5% and so on. But they understood that some of these other homes had alternate funding sources that they could rely upon. Do most of the homes in the area you're talking about have alternate funding sources, like a lot of Medicare beds, or they're attached to hospitals or other revenue streams? Well, they depended pretty much on the state Medicaid money.
Mr. Chairman, dependent upon MA, about the MA reimbursement. And as you know, with the private pay, equal pay law, private public pay we have in Minnesota, they're not able to obtain tremendous other resources from private pay patients. There will be administrators coming forward here in the next few minutes, and maybe the question might be best for them as to what their alternative funding sources may be.
Thank you.
Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps I should address this to Mr. Chun, but I don't know anything about nursing home rates, but I get a sense I'm going to learn a lot on this committee. But I'm wondering, is there a sense that the geographic groupings even make sense anymore? I mean, I'm just thinking in terms of, having the whole metro as one area, when there's such diversity even within the metro region, and I'm sure in Minnesota it's different if you're in a regional center versus a smaller rural area in terms of competition for the biggest cost driver, which is personnel. You've got inner city facilities that have a hard time recruiting because of safety concerns around their campus. You have greater Minnesota places that just don't have any nurses nearby, and it's hard to get people to drive there. I mean, is the core basis of a geographic breakdown rather than something else ever been looked at, or does it still seem to be a good reflection of the local labor stress?
Mr. Chair and Mr. Loeffler, the original three geographic groups were established in the 80s, and I don't remember the exact measures, but I know that one of the measures they used in defining the three groups was, I think, average nursing salaries. But I think you're right that there are a lot of factors that people bring up about why it's not fair to assume, for example, that all costs in certain regions would be lower than, say, costs in the metro area. But I'm not aware of any sort of type of, detailed analysis that actually compares the underlying costs with the rates. I think a lot of the information we hear is more anecdotal.
Mr. Chairman, if I could just, Representative Loeffler, just very quickly respond. I think that if you look at, and I think in your packets, is there a map of the three geographic locations?
No, we don't have a map of the economic development region.
Of the economic development regions. I do have a map of the three geographic regions with me that I would be glad to share with you. Somewhat arbitrary, I think you will see as you look at the map. And I would argue one of two things. I'd argue, first of all, that the market for the nursing home in Dodge Center is exactly the same labor market as the homes and the healthcare facilities in Rochester, 18 miles away. yet the reimbursements are significantly different. You cannot compete in that market. I would argue that the market for the nursing assistants and for the LPNs and the RNs in Willmar is exactly the same as that of St. Cloud, some 60 miles away. But the person in between, living in between, can go either way. And if that market, if that argument isn't correct, I believe it's correct. I think the market choices and the market that you have to meet is the same, whether you're in Dodge Center or in Rochester. If that is not correct, then I will take the second argument that I have, and that would be that we should not be treating a personnel, caregivers, labor, nurses, LPNs, whatever it is, in a Worthington, Minnesota, as second-class citizens to a Rochester or a Hopkins or a you name the other facility in geographic group 3 or 2. One of the two arguments has to hold.
Okay. Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chair, just to clarify, I'm not arguing against the bill.
I'm just trying to think through,
you know, sort of whether or not even just grouping by geography makes any sense, as opposed to responding to the particular situation and the particular patient mix of a particular facility. I'm just thinking this through as we go.
Sure.
Representative Bunn.
Chair, Representative Switham, but also Randall Chung, this might be, it's a follow-up on the same question. I also, as an economist, the thing that occurred to me, I assume the history of this had to do with different labor markets in these areas, or at least a presumption that there had been some research done on that originally. I also believe we need to increase this in the nursing facilities area, and I'm supportive of that, but I also expect there are probably still labor market issues that would justify having differential rates, not that the current formulas or the current geographic regions or the way it's done now is the correct one. So I guess my question is, has there been updating of the research to understand where the labor markets are for this sector so that we might inform it in some way that makes sense as opposed to just trying to get rid of the gaps?
Mr. Chun.
Mr. Chair, Representative Bunn, that's probably actually a better question maybe for our economic development analysts who would be more familiar with some of the labor markets, but I guess I'm not aware of any sort of recent updates of, say, the geographic groups for purposes of nursing home reimbursement, and part of that is because the current reimbursement system, although it's sort of historically influenced by these rates, it doesn't currently, you know, directly take into account geographic, you know, location. It's more of a fixed, you know, rate upon rate system.
Representative Bunn.
Just a quick follow-up comment. I mean, this issue comes up in a number of different areas of policy that you address. I mean, in terms of the school funding formula, that's up for discussion there in terms of metro, non-metro, those kinds of things. The labor markets can be quite different in terms of what the average wages are in them in terms of how they need to be funded. So it's a broader issue for us to consider the legislature. We might look at what's being done in those other policy areas as well. Thank you.
I don't know about nursing home rates members, but I can tell you that nurses that work in hospitals get paid almost identically in St. Cloud as they do in the Twin Cities, as they do in Rochester, as they do in Duluth. So at least for the RN market, it's pretty even across the state. We go to the testifiers, Kari Thurlow and Patty Cullen. And could you state your names when you talk, just for the record?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Patty Cullen, Vice President at Care Providers of Minnesota, and I'm one of the two people speaking on behalf of the Long-Term Care Imperative.
Good afternoon. My name is Carrie Thurlow. I'm the Vice President of Advocacy for the Minnesota Health and Housing Alliance, and we comprise the second member of the Long-Term Care Imperative.
I'd like to thank Representative Swigum and members of the committee for taking this bill up today so early in the session, and also want to recognize we have quite a few members of our associations that travel a great distance to attend this hearing, so we'd like to thank you for coming in support of this bill. We also want to extend our thanks to members of this committee who have authored or co-authored or will be authoring or co-authoring a variety of other approaches to address the issues relating to nursing facility reimbursement. And we have spoken with many of you. Some of you have already introduced bills that deal with your approach, and this is another approach toward moving us in the direction where we believe we need to have the nursing home rates looking at. You have a handout, hopefully, one of many in your packet, that's a beautiful color chart. Hopefully that was enough for everyone in the committee. This is a document that we have been distributing to legislators this year. Even though it's 2005 data, we won't have an updated version of this until March based on the financial information obtained from the 2006 financial reports of our member facilities. They fill out detailed reports that show their finances, and we contract with Larson Allen, who comes up with these statistics that shows the financial condition of nursing facilities. And we think it's important for you to take a look at the map and to look at the areas of the state in particular where there's a high percentage of facilities that are looking at negative operating margins of negative 5% or greater. And we leave that with you as an idea to look at. And you see that the highest percentages here are in rural communities, partly due to the fact that more metro facilities have closed, so their statistics looks good this year, but also because of the reporting mechanism of the reporting that has been done by our member facilities. Representative Abler isn't here, but I'd like to add a comment on his question about alternative revenue sources. About 70% of the days in nursing facilities are Medicaid days, with the remainder of the days being Medicare, long-term care insurance, private pay, and the like. And there is a competition in rural Minnesota for Medicare payment because either the critical access hospital is going to have the swing bed opens and get the Medicare payment for those long-term care days, or the skilled nursing facility is going to have the Medicare payment for those same patients. So that is an issue that in particular rural Minnesota experience. So with those introductory comments, as you know, nursing facilities are a very important part of Minnesota's economy. A significant change in the number of nursing facilities and those they employ in the state would have a direct economic impact, which is felt more strongly, I believe, in rural Minnesota.
Our research, thank you, Patty, and I also want to thank Representative Swigum for the opportunity to come in and discuss with you today long-term care financing. We hope to have more of these opportunities as we move forward to discuss the range of possibilities for meeting the needs of long-term care providers throughout the state of Minnesota. I also want to emphasize Patty's point that nursing facilities provide not only important care for our seniors throughout Minnesota, but they are important economic engines throughout local economies. We estimate that nursing facilities employ over 55,000 full-time employees throughout the state of Minnesota. They create or provide about $1.1 billion worth of salaries throughout the state, and an additional $237 million worth of payroll taxes. In other words, the closure of nursing facilities will ripple through other economic sectors, will have a huge impact on the state economy, and other areas of the economy will respond proportionately.
And we do want to leave time for the members who have driven to do the testimony. So our testimony is going to be very short, and we can certainly respond to technical questions. For people who haven't been on this committee, and there's quite a few of you, one of the proposals pending this session would require the Department of Human Services to rebase nursing facility rates in 2008. Until that time, however, this proposal, House File 55, will actually line us up and give us, I guess, more even boundaries to look ahead at the rebasing. When folks have asked us about rebasing of rates, we do have, as Mr. Chun said, a rate-on-rate system. We did have a pseudo-cost-based system in the early 90s, but starting in 1993, there were limits placed on a variety of areas of cost, so you really didn't have your costs recognized under that system since 1993. It's very unusual for any state human services program, be it hospitals, nursing homes, or whatever, to have this length of time between rebasing opportunities. Because as you know, when you have the lower rate facilities that don't have their costs recognized to start with, and the only increases given are an inflationary multiplier, you actually widen the gap over time rather than try to address the disparity. So we want to make sure folks know that it's been that long since we've had rebasing. We're hoping that that gets done in the near future, but in the meantime, this proposal will certainly help a large group of facilities at least meet their financial considerations.
I think we'll just answer questions at this point. Yeah. Any time
if there's no questions, we could get on to the next testifiers, but don't go away.
Mr. Chairman, we will stay within your allotted half hour time to respect your time and that of the committees. I do have a number of administrators who are here that would like to maybe make a quick comment.
Certainly. We had some on the list here. John Boughton.
John Boughton. Full disclaimer, members, he's from Kenny.
Yes. I was.
And even a fuller disclaimer, the home that he runs is owned by a number of churches in the area. It's the Kenyan Sunset Home, and tonight they have their annual meeting, and I may be elected to go on his board. So nobody else is running, so maybe I'll. But it's completely volunteer, also. But I think you have to bring donuts or cookies once in a while, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so it's hostile. Go ahead.
Mr. Boughton, would you just state your name for the record?
Yes, sir. My name is John Boughton. I'm the administrator of the Kenyan Sunset Home, and I appreciate, Mr. Chairman, the opportunity to speak today, and I want to thank Representative Swigum for sponsoring this bill. I had the opportunity over the years to be a nursing home administrator for a little over 20 years with a little four-year hiatus here in the last couple of years pursuing another interest. I just came back here in 2005, and the years I was absent of 2001 and 2005 have been a time where nursing homes have had incredible stresses placed on them, and I am just now beginning to fully realize myself how critical the issues are. The Kenyan Sunset Home is a 58-bed facility. We have 19 units of senior housing with services. As Representative Swigum has mentioned, we're a nonprofit, a 501c3 owned by area churches. We're also an economic engine. We're the second largest employer in the city of Kenyon, employing 85 individuals, mostly from the community, with a payroll in the nursing home of a little over $2 million annually and $100,000 in our housing project. For most of my time, nursing homes are a place where people came and stayed for extended periods of time that you would look at in not even days or months, but typically years. As you'll see from the information I've provided you today, it's become a bit different now. This last year, we had 145 admissions to our little 58-bed facility and 144 discharges. Most of the discharges are people who go to apartments, so typical nursing home resident now stays with us not for months or years, but typically days. The financial stresses in the facilities, you'll see from the handout as well, in 2001 and 2002, the facility had the last 2 years where there was a positive bottom line, a small one, but a positive bottom line. And since then, there have been an increasing loss position in the facility, resulting in a rather substantial loss of this year of $375,000 on just a little over $3.6 million revenue. In 2005 was my first full year or half a year in the facility. Our loss was driven primarily by the need to have pool nurses and nursing assistants to fill staff pools and additional consulting fees that were incurred by the facility prior to my arrival. In 2006, we had hoped to put things back on a better position, but halfway through the year, we had about two-thirds of our Medicare A days disappear in the facility for almost half the year, and that lost us in the ballpark of $150,000 annually, projected to $175,000 in lost revenue. We also had additional costs that made up almost the entire amount in the nursing department, primarily, and difficulty in recruiting and retaining staff. It has driven, as you can see by the revenue expense trend line, a downward spiral for us, and our revenue expense gap widens and our loss increases annually. The facility back in 2001 had some available cash. It had roughly $1 million available to them in their foundation. Prior to my arrival, about 600,000 of that was spent on two improvements, some remodeling and renovation of the facility, as well as the addition of the 19-unit housing with services project. Since that time, primarily, we've gone from about a little over 400,000 to a little over 200,000 now remaining in our foundation. And the last 2 years, that money has primarily been used to cover operating losses. So that represents, at this point, somewhere between 2 to 3 weeks of operating revenue we have left available to us from all sources. It's a pretty close margin. We have, as we look forward to the 06-07, tried to address this again this year. We have de-licensed six beds, have been approved to de-license six beds, which will bring in an additional $60,000 annually through the reimbursement system. And we've cut well in excess of $100,000 in operating costs, primarily in the areas of staffing, because 70 cents out of every dollar that we receive goes to the staffing of payroll and benefits. We are hoping we can maintain those cuts, and if we do, we anticipate an annual loss in the upcoming year of about $100,000, which would put us in a very tough but a positive cash flow position. Just some examples of the day-to-day difficulties we have that would be addressed by this bill. We've been advertising for nurse on the night shift here for about the past 2 months. We've had one individual apply, and she opted not to take the job. At the time we started, we had to terminate one of our night nurses. We have two. And since that time, the second person has decided to leave, primarily because they live in the Cannon Falls area and can work up in the metro for better salary and better benefits. No takers. We started by advertising the position, and we advertised it with a $1,000 sign-on bonus, and now we've started advertising as of this week with a $2,000 sign-on bonus, and we can't even get anybody to come in the door. In Kenyon, Minnesota, you can be at the metro area in 30 to 45 minutes. You can be in Rochester in about the same amount of time. There's lots of opportunities, and even though we're considered outstate, we certainly are well within reach of metro areas. We recently hired an RN manager, another example of some of the difficulties we're having to supervise one of our wings. She came from a hospital here in the metro area, had moved down to the nurse friend area close to us and thought it would be better to live in the area. She initially found that she'd be making $15 less per hour to take the position. And we would have paid her more, but it would have put us over our director of nursing, our highest paid employee in the department. She agreed to take the position. Then we realized, and she realized, we hadn't discussed medical benefits. We discussed medical employee health plan benefits. She was the sole provider for her family. To find out that her share of health care in our facility would be about $1,200 per month, per share. That's on top of what we would pay. She kind of gulped and said, I'll come back and I'll do this and we'll make it work. She worked for 1 day for us, didn't show up the second day. And when we called her to find out, she said her transmission had gone out on the way home after that day. She'd spent the whole night up with her husband and decided there was no way she could work in an outstate facility and had to return to a consulting job she's now doing, where she flies to California, works 4 days a week, and comes home on weekends. That pays her approximately $40 an hour. We had a nursing assistant, probably the best one on our staff, just leave yesterday. She lives in Faribault. She drives to Kenyon. It's a 15 to 20 minute drive. She found she could go up to the Burnsville area, make a higher salary. Her health care will cost her, her portion will be one quarter, 25% of the cost here at that metro area nursing home in Burnsville. She will get a pension there. We had to abandon our pension a couple of years ago when there was no rate increases. The pension was abandoned prior to my coming. She will get free dental for her daughter, and she's a single mom, and this is very important to her. Our dental is totally paid by the employee. As I talk about health care, also just to mention that during those couple of years when there was no rate increases, they passed on, and the facility made the choice to pass on all increases to the employees. So currently we have 24 individuals out of 85 who take our employee health plan. They take it as employees only, and nobody can afford the family coverage there, including myself, who receive it through my wife and her job. We've done a lot to make changes to bring the budget in line, but basically we're sitting here, as I said, with 2 to 3 weeks of cash, and if the census goes down, if our Medicare days decline again, if we have to begin relying on pool staff, all of which could put us in a negative cash flow position, and the facility could survive for not years but literally months, and we would be faced with not being able to meet payroll or bills and closure. Representative Swiggum's bill, as per the information you handed out today, would increase our revenue by $352,000, according to your numbers. Given we lost $346,000 this last year, I think that's a pretty good number, and we'd certainly be happy to see it. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to you today. I would certainly be here in support of this bill. We need it, and the sad part of this is there's nothing unique about our facility. I think in many respects, most of the facilities you would talk to and administrators would share much of the same story. We're all not years away, but months away from some pretty critical decisions as to whether we can keep the doors open or not. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Boughton, and we're not going to have time for questions, but we have two more speakers, and if they could keep it short.
Administrator Wetzel from Dodge Center Nursing Home, I think he's there. And Mr. Chairman, thank you for your time. I appreciate it very, very much. And we'll be respectful of the committee's time. Anyone?
Just state your name.
Respectful. My name is Neil Witzel. I actually am the Director of Nursing of Cedarview Care Center in Owatonna, Minnesota. And have prepared for you a handout that the pages are passing out right now. And actually, some of the questions that you asked about cost, weight factors as far as the RUGS level of different areas, I've got some graphs on there that will show that to you in a very specific manner. I want to real briefly just address this. This started up, and I helped got this going to begin with. Mr. Swiggum was, Representative Swiggum was very kind to actually put this bill together. I started this out as a campaign, talking to six of our local legislators out of the Dodge Center, Dodge County, and Steele County area, and looking at some of the things that were going on within our facilities. I have the same struggle. I manage 150 people in the nursing department and a $3 million a year nursing payroll budget. And I have the same struggle as the previous administrator mentioned, trying to hire people, because I have a hospital in my area that pays my RNs substantially more wages than what I can pay my staff there at the facility. Also, as well as nursing assistants, we are probably, our facility is one of the second highest pay places in the area for nursing assistants. But there's another facility just down the road from us that their payroll is only about, starting for a CNA, is about $8.25 an hour. Now, if you were a single mom and you had a couple kids, you think you can live on $8.25 an hour? I don't believe that can happen too well in this day and age. Going down this, I had some of the comments I was going to make, but I'll make the short. In the time that I've been a director of nursing and Cedarview Care Center, which has been about 5 years, I came in the facility. We had a lot of equipment that needed to be replaced. There wasn't the money to do it in a capital budget. We did it mostly out of the nursing department budget. We replaced probably 50 wheelchairs. We replaced several mattresses on beds, several specialized mattresses, and so on. But it's just an ongoing issue. And even in my budget for 2007, I built a lot of that in place. We want more mats, more mattresses for our residents, more specialized wheelchair cushions. And you know, some of the studies that are out right now say by the year 2020, there'll be more people over age 65 than there are underneath 25 in the state of Minnesota. So we do have a graying population, and I can testify to that myself. If you look at the information I gave you real quickly, and I know our time is tight, but I did put a little key together at the top there, Southeastern Minnesota Nursing Facilities. What I actually did is did a wage survey and benefits last summer for that area. And that is connected to the information that's back in some of the other stuff that you got in that packet. I did a little bit of a summary in that, and you'll see that at the second table on the first page there is the wage and benefits. I just picked two facilities there, and I picked the hospital. As you can see across there, the hospital could start out nursing RNs at $24 an hour. We start them out at $18. There's quite a discrepancy. Top end for those RNs at the hospital is $35. For our area, it's $20 to $25. It makes quite a bit of difference when that gentleman was describing that resident wing manager up at Kenyon. If you look at the top section here, the rug levels, what I did is I just took two facilities in the metro area. I took one in Olmsted County, I took one in Steele County, and one in Dodge County. And I picked out four of those 34 classifications of rug levels, and I even put a nice little key explainer down here at the bottom of that. And you can see the difference between the different rug levels in these facilities. If you look at that SE3, we go anywhere from $203 up to $288. That's a per-day reimbursement for those facilities. That's a difference of $75, $85 per day, per facility, per person, if they have a SE3. If they go down to a PE1, there's a difference of roughly anywhere from $35 up a little more than that. Now, my facility alone, I figured if I had a $10 increase a day, put me back more in the playing field with the metro and the Olmsted County facilities. $10 a day, 108 residents, we stay full all the time. We don't have an occupancy problem in our facility. Times 365 is $365,000 difference that would make in our operating expense. We'd be able to put more employees on. We'd be able to pay more benefits and wages for our employees. And the outcome would be is that our senior citizens would not be the forgotten generation. And I just put a real summary together there on the back page, on the second page of that first part of the handout there. I actually have two instances of continuing education that I lost good key staff to because I can't offer scholarship programs or continuing education programs to people to further their education. One employee that I had hired actually called me back like 2 days later, who was going to come to work for me part-time, went to work for a medical clinic in a neighboring town, but because she could work part-time, she was offered a scholarship to even go to further her education as an RN. I can't do that in my facility. Another gal who was an RN who wanted to go on and get a master's degree and in education ended up going to work at the Mayo Clinic in Rochester because she had that opportunity offered to her there. At the middle of that page, you'll see some comparatives of medical care costs of what our area clinic charges, what the hospital charges. And on weekends when the clinic isn't open or nights when the clinic isn't open, if we have a doctor's order that says, get this, get that, and we take it over there, these are the expenses that we have to pay. Some of those costs are twice or three times higher than what they should be just by going to utilize the hospital. Real briefly, my colleagues and I in this industry feel that the rural nursing facility rugs levels need to be increased to median 3, median rate that the Metro Olmsted, Stearns, Sherburne, and Benton counties fall under at this time. Nursing facilities experience, rural nursing facilities experience high medical costs, compromised employee recruitment and retention is a big key area there, non-competitive wages and benefits, and employer staffing ratios per resident in comparison to facilities operating underneath the Group 3 structure. As rural nursing homes are now also in the competition for the ever-shrinking qualified workforce, how can these facilities be expected to compete with metro or other facilities, such as hospitals, and that when most rural facilities receive less operating funding? One of the most important reasons I feel to equalize these rates is for the ultimate benefit of our senior citizens who reside in these rural facilities. Our senior citizens should not be the forgotten generation. Thank you for your time. I appreciate you looking at this bill and considering it for us. We really do need it.
Thank you, Neil.
Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, one more, or would you want
to? One more, if you could keep it very brief. More,
very, very quickly. And
a couple of minutes.
As he is coming up, Mr. Chairman, again, thank you all for the look at the disparity. The House, as Mr. Abel said, has historically tried to address this. We have done some steps. We need to finish the job.
You state your name for the record.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, committee members. Hello, my name is Jeff King. I'm the Chief Financial Officer at Three Links Care Center. Prior to joining Three Links Care Center, I spent 8 years in the healthcare industry at Larson Allen Wisher & Company, serving the healthcare facilities. Three Links Care Center is a 102-bed skilled nursing facility located in Northfield. We've been at that location for 108 years. We are a rural facility in Rice County that employs approximately 130 full-time equivalents. We are exactly 1.2 miles from the Dakota County border. Dakota County falls into the metro reimbursement rate. In addition, our community hospital opened a new facility in Dakota County and is being reimbursed at the metro rate. While we are grateful for the intent of the scholarship program, and we have had many staff further their education because of it, we have had several staff leave after their graduation because they can earn a higher wage in our local hospital, metro hospitals, and nursing homes. Imagine the discontent when a brand new RN leaves our facility to work at Northfield Hospital and announces their pay will be equal to or greater than a seasoned RN at Three Links Care Center. In addition to the salary concerns, we have seen our operating margins continue to decline. For the year ended December 31st, 2003, for our care center, we are operating at a negative 1.8 margin. Year to date through November for 2006, our care center is at a negative 6.8 margin. Rate increases from the state have been minimal over the last 4 years. We received 0% in 2003 and 2004, and approximately 2.25% in 2005 and 2006. This equates to a little more than 1% per year. Also, 75% of the increase has been encumbered for compensation increases. This leaves little to cover other operating expenses. Our energy costs have risen. We are unable to pass this cost on, yet our vendors all apply a fuel surcharge. We received a 20% increase in our health insurance, which was passed on to our employees. Let me give you an example of one of our dedicated nursing assistants. She has worked at Three Links Care Center for 23 years. She gives wonderful care to our residents with Alzheimer's disease. Her wage is $12.77 per hour. Her husband, who is periodically self-employed due to several bouts of recurring cancer, they have three children. Her take-home pay every 2 weeks is $384. How do they manage? Our operating costs per day, excluding depreciation and interest, are about $180.49. Our current daily room revenue, including all payer sources, is $152.15 per day. This equates to a $28.34 shortfall, just to break even. Under the current proposed House Bill 55, adjusting to the median rate of the geographic group 3 would increase our rates approximately $17.28 per day. This is a great start, and I encourage you to pass the bill. If this bill is not passed, we will be forced to make deeper cuts to our direct care and our programs. Three Links is one of the 8 largest employers in our community. A further loss of jobs will directly and negatively impact the economic viability of our community. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. King, and thank you, Representative Swigum. I think we're sort of prisoners of a time prior to interstate highways, and we basically do have one job market in Minnesota.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members.
With that, I will... House File 55 is laid over for possible inclusion in the final omnibus bill. And we'll get on with Assistant Commissioner Coleman.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. Again, Lauren Coleman, Assistant Commissioner for Continuing Care at the Department of Human Services. To continue with our budget presentation, I'm on page 178. Mm-hmm. This proposal is whereby the governor is recommending applying waiver provider standards required under the mental retardation and related conditions waiver to similar services in the community alternative care, the community alternatives for disabled individuals, and the traumatic brain injury waiver. It would help ensure that the health and safety of all waiver recipients and create a common compliance standard for the providers. In recent years, both state and federal policymakers have been focusing on strengthening the integrity of the home and community-based service programs. Specific quality assurance guidelines have been established by the Centers for Medicare and Medicaid Services, CMS, that require states to demonstrate that continuous monitoring of the health and welfare safety of waiver participants and that remediation actions are initiated where appropriate. We are required to report to CMS on these services and verify that providers do in fact meet quality standards and to report to CMS on an annual basis. The new waiver protocols that CMS has advanced puts that responsibility on us. Currently, Minnesota does not have consistent provider standards that apply to providers who are paid under the CADI, CAC, and TBI programs. These three programs will serve approximately 13,500 people in fiscal year 2008. The governor's budget proposal is designed to ensure that the health, safety, and protection of the rights of all individuals in the home community-based waiver programs are honored. The proposal establishes a common set of provider standards that cover that basic health and safety, such as assessing a person's vulnerability, first aid and medication administration, handling a person's funds, use of behavioral interventions, and other basic provisions. We propose to use existing provider standards that are already used for providers of services in the MRRC waiver. It doesn't mean that the providers will meet them in identical ways, but the same elements that need to be demonstrated under this proposal would be required. The proposal utilizes those basic standards that are very familiar to many of the affected provider organizations. Our view is that 65% of the provider organizations that are impacted by this proposal are already using standards in other settings that they provide services. There are about 955 foster care providers, and about two-thirds of them already have what is called a 245B license. That's the standards that we're referring to here. So, again, two-thirds of that provider group is familiar with what it will take to meet this licensure requirement. There are about 253 providers of independent living skills services in Minnesota that would be impacted. And again, about 55% of those organizations are already meeting standards in other programs. There are approximately 172 providers of day supports that would be impacted by this, and about 80% of those organizations already hold a 245B license. Part of this proposal also recommends a rate adjustment for those providers who need to meet this new licensure requirement. That would range, depending upon the organization, from approximately 1.5% to 3% in order to meet these established requirements. This requirement also requests additional licensing staff to process the applications and to conduct the reviews that a license would require.
Any questions? Representative Abert.
Is that the end of this topic, and we're going to move on to the next one?
I think he's getting ready to move on.
Okay, so I have a couple of questions then. These standards, I presume you've shopped these around the providers, and they're all really happy, or are they going to tell us that they have some concern?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I'm not going to speak for the providers, but these are known standards. We've not proposed any new standards that would need to be required. So they are familiar with them. They would likely suggest that there is a cost associated with developing and implementing the standards, and we've accommodated that in the budget proposal.
And two more.
Representative Aber.
Are we going to take some current providers who are fine and providing low-cost services and make them all be higher-cost providers by doing this?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think the cost that will be associated with meeting this this group of standards will be modest. Again, many, 65% of the provider organizations that are already doing business are meeting standards in the MRRC waiver program. So they are familiar to them. They would need to apply a similar discipline and a similar demonstration to the other programs that they're receiving funding.
And one more.
The neighbor.
I'm not doing real well, Mr. Chair. But and is there going to be a savings or some better outcomes that we can expect from this, or is it like that save, like that other investigation thing where we're going to do some work and not save any money and find any people who are wrong? Do you expect a positive outcome from this, or do you just presume that they'll be better because they meet a higher standard?
Mr. Chair, Representative Abler, I think that the primary benefit will be to the consumer and to both the state and county officials who will have the authority to intervene in circumstances where standards are not being met. Currently, because there is no requirement to meet the standards, enforcement is not always available to us.
Thank you.
Commissioner, do you know how much time you're going to need here? Because we have two other people waiting, and I'm afraid we won't get to them, and I might as well just tell them to...
well, I'll move as quickly as I can. I don't have a lot yet to present, so okay. We're going to skip page 180 to 192. That helps move us along. Those pages will be presented by Assistant Commissioner Wes Koistra, because those programs are managed in the Chemical and Mental Health Administration. So I'm going to continue on page 193. And very briefly, Minnesota has been a leader in providing services to deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind individuals in Minnesota, a leader in the country. There are approximately 67,000 Minnesotans who are deaf and about 500,000 individuals who have some form of hearing loss. Sign language interpreter referral services allow deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind Minnesotans to access core services such as the courts, educational programs, mental health services, law enforcement, and medical care. Deafblind grants supports adults who are both deaf and blind so that they can live independently and stay in their own homes. It also provides grants to deafblind children and their families with services that result in enhanced community integration. Next part of the program provides specialized mental health services to those individuals who are deaf, hard of hearing, and deafblind, who have unique needs because of their mental illness. And last, this provides funding for real-time closed captioning grants so that deafblind and hard of hearing consumers have access to the media and local live news programming in greater Minnesota. We measure how well we're doing on page 194, and I'll draw your attention to the percent of certified interpreters throughout Minnesota and the percent of interpreting service requests that are filled. We're doing a very nice job in filling 97% of requests if we have 24 hours notice, 91% if we include last-minute requests. And you can see the other measurements that we try to track and see how well we're doing. Related to this, though, I'm going to move to page 197, which says we still have unmet needs. We still have individuals that need more service than we're able to provide currently. And so the governor is recommending that we expand the existing Deafblind Support Program to provide services to an additional 80 unserved children and adults with a dual sensory loss. Again, this is for people who are both deaf and blind. Trying to be cautious of the time. Again, we are trying to address the need that children have for incidental learning, learning at the moment, with a specialized set of skills by individuals who are called interveners, who work with families and the young child to make sure that they are learning from their experience as children. Without this kind of support, the evidence suggests that they will need more services as they become adults. So you can't go back and re-teach those moments that you missed as a young child. So this would expand that to about 25 additional children and families. Additionally, this funding would provide services to 55 adults who are either living in the community needing supports to remain independent, or living in an institution who would move into the community if they had this kind of limited support to help them with grocery shopping, banking, various affairs of living independently. An additional component of this, which is a modest but still an important component, is the coverage of sign language interpreter services in our healthcare programs. Currently, providers with more than 15 employees are required to pay for sign language interpreter services when requested by a participant in the medical assistants or GMAC. This would provide an avenue for them to bill and be able to provide sign language interpreter services similar to oral language interpreter services that is currently provided for in our healthcare programs. But again, it's modest. The frequency is not huge. But at the moment, when you're trying to receive healthcare services and you're having a difficult time communicating with your healthcare provider, it's critically important. So that is the change page related to deaf and hard of hearing and deafblind services.
Questions? Commissioner, proceed.
We'll move now to, let's see here, other grants. Page 207. Again, we're skipping a little bit, which will be covered by others. We have a variety of other grant programs that are administered through continuing care. Family support grants, consumer support grants, semi-independent living skills, and HIV grants. Let me briefly describe the programs and what they attempt to achieve. The family support grant, first of all, I will note, is state dollars that provide a cash assistance to families to purchase supports for a child with a disability. There is an income standard. We currently serve about 1,600 children at an average cost annually of about $2,500. There is a demand for this service. There are about, from what is reported to us, about 1,300 people waiting for a family support grant. It allows families to offset some of the higher costs that are associated with raising a child with a certified disability. Allowable expenses could include daycare, educational services, medical services, computers, respite care, specialized clothing, special dietary needs, etc. These are individuals who are not and cannot be on a waiver, so they're not eligible for that program. So it's our way as Minnesotans to support them with a grant. The next grant on this page is consumer support grants. Consumer support grants help people with functional limitations and their families purchase supports to, again, help people remain as independent as possible. You can be on medical assistance and still be eligible for a consumer support grant. Recipients receive a grant amount less than or equal to the state share of the amount of certain long-term care services that they would receive under MA. So that's the trade-off, to get the cash grant to, again, make decisions that support you. You are able to receive the state portion of the funding stream. The next grant opportunity is semi-independent living skills. These are administered through the county, and they assist adults with mental retardation or related condition, again, live successfully in the community. There's a theme here. We're trying to keep people in the community at a modest cost. These are individuals who we are supporting who are not necessarily at risk of institutionalization, and yet their needs are important. We serve about 1,600 adults at an average annual cost of about $4,900. We know that, as reported by the counties, there are about 638 individuals waiting for semi-independent living skills funding. So there is a demand there. The last grant on this page is HIV/AIDS services. HIV/AIDS grants cover services specifically for HIV-infected individuals to help maintain insurance coverage and provide early intervention and cost-effective care. We are the payer of last resort in this program. It's the stopgap service that are provided to individuals who are not eligible for other similar benefits through Minnesota healthcare programs such as medical assistance or general assistance medical care. We help about 1,400 individuals in Minnesota who are living with HIV/AIDS pay for these services. They can be insurance costs, they can be dental costs, nutrition costs, prescription drugs, mental health services, etc. There's a lot of information about the HIV/AIDS program. Again, trying to be respectful of the time, I won't go into all the details, but I will note that service continuation for this population is critical. If a pharmaceutical regimen is not adhered to, is skipped because of lack of availability of either insurance coverage or prescription drug coverage, for some individuals, even for a single day, that drug then becomes non-effective in helping them manage their HIV/AIDS illness. We have a funding request on page 211 that addresses, that recommends that we increase the base budget for this program to allow for the continuation of insurance program funding for the individuals that need this support, and additionally to move this into the healthcare access fund as a medical service. The program currently serves about 565 people with insurance coverage support. We've run a continuous deficit in this program for the last several years. requiring us to be very aggressive in managing each and every dollar. We have implemented a number of elements in this program consistent with our other healthcare programs, such as cost sharing and co-pays, etc., for individuals who are participating in this program. Without the additional resources of the program and the active management that we've needed to pursue in the last several years, we would have to go to either waiting lists and deny eligibility or deny people from entering the program, or we would have to look at eligibility changes that would also restrict the ability to support these people. What we need to acknowledge in this program is that although it is 16, 17 years old now, the nature of HIV/AIDS illness has changed. People are living longer. They are being able to be healthier, and so therefore it creates the financial pressures. We need to support people for longer periods of time. Additionally, we are seeing younger people who are entering and applying for the program, which certainly is of concern. The proposal will allow an additional 40 individuals in fiscal year 08 and 60 individuals in 09 to participate in the insurance program. It's a cost-effective program to help people maintain existing insurance that they have coverage through. And without it, they would either be unable to obtain insurance because of existing conditions, or the cost would be prohibitive.
Representative Abler.
Mr. Chair, I think it'd be a good topic for a future meeting to look at creative uses of the healthcare access fund for worthy ideas and just the history and what it's all going for now. Is there a paper on it or something?
Representative Abler, I have a bill that I address that. Representative Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Commissioner, you've got, you say you serve approximately 565 people in that. Is there a follow-up as far as the outcomes of what's happening, results of the service that you provide?
Mr. Chair, Representative.
Mr. Commissioner.
This is helping people maintain their insurance. We are seeing growing pressures on this because we're not seeing people leaving the program as we once did. So it in and of itself is kind of a success because people are able to keep their insurance and maintain their health because they're getting more timely health care services. We went through literally a case-by-case examination over the last couple years to try to remain within the appropriation, and looked at each individual in the HIV/AIDS programs, identified how best to help them maintain their health, and so I would deem it to be successful because we're not seeing the people exit from the program as we once did. The one of the challenges, if I might, new drugs are coming on the market all the time, and they're more successful. They're easier to administer, but they're also more costly. We pay the price for the research and development that pharmaceutical companies are learning how to treat HIV/AIDS infected individuals better.
Thank you. Representative Lawler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner. Can you talk a little bit about, I've heard that there's real problems within this population in meeting copay requirements for drugs and other medications, and that there's some ongoing concerns about whether the ADAP funding is going to be able to the federal money is going to be able to keep up with demand here. Can you tell us a little bit more about, you know, how you see this evolving?
Sure. Mr. Chair, Representative Lothar. We are awaiting the federal appropriation for the federal portion of this funding. The authorization for HIV ADAP funding has passed Congress, but the appropriation, the money, hasn't been determined yet. So I can't predict how well the funding from the federal government will flow to Minnesota. We're cautiously optimistic that it will help us, at least in the near future, the next 4 years, meet our needs. We, again, referencing looking at a case-by-case basis with our current population that we're supporting, the end result was what we only found 8 individuals, actually some of those we couldn't find, that we couldn't match their needs to a specific program. So even though we implemented cost sharing and co-pays, et cetera, we really worked long and hard at a management level to make sure that we didn't lose anybody in the process. There is a hardship provision. There is funding available that we work through policy council that sets aside a small amount of money for those individuals who truly can't afford cost sharing, and they can apply for that through the policy council. So we can't control whether they do apply or not, but there is that funding mechanism available if people truly need a waiver from that requirement.
Representative Lothar.
And just to follow up, Mr. Chairman and Assistant Commissioner, of those 8 people, I understand several disappeared, you couldn't follow up, but for the others, was there an issue of, you know, mental health issues that they weren't able to follow up? And what do you think are the reasons that you weren't able to fill the gap for those individuals?
Commissioner.
Mr. Chair, Representative Lothar, we were successful in matching individuals who were eligible for medical assistance so that they could continue coverage under that program. We were successful in matching people who were eligible for Medicare Part D. This was all kind of occurring in the same context of Medicare Part D, and some of the individuals that were in the program were eligible for that benefit and were able to enroll under Medicare Part D. So I'm not sure who else you're referring to. If people were not able to be identified through medical providers or county case managers or last known addresses, you know, there wasn't anything more. And that's the 8 individuals that I believe I'm referencing. I just want to look to my staff and make sure I'm quoting it. Okay. Yes.
Representative Loeffler.
Mr. Chairman, members, my question was just because if we lose 8, I mean, oftentimes it's because they have, I mean, as you can imagine, when you have a life-threatening illness and difficult expenses, trying to juggle just living expenses, you may have lost your job because of your illness, those sorts of things. Oftentimes it's depression and other things that keep people from, you know, being able to reach out or fill out that appeals to the hardship case, and I would hope we'd really make some special outreach to people that we know are vulnerable.
Commissioner.
The next budget activity is on page 213, and it describes our continuing care management and some of the activities that we are responsible for. Obviously, a lot of the programs, or all of the programs that I've identified in the previous pages, are under our administration. It'd be somewhat repetitive to go through that again. A different set of obligations are identified on page 213 with a number of councils and boards that we also support through our staffing. I don't think there's a lot more that I need to say about the management structure, but I certainly would answer any questions that you might have about that.
Any questions?
And the last page that I have is on page 217, which is also a legislative proposal. The governor recommends expanding the scope of the nursing home report card assessment to include 11 additional nursing homes. Currently, not all nursing homes in Minnesota participate in the report card that we talked about yesterday. There are 11 facilities. There are several veterans homes that are not required to participate, as well as several non-medical assistance or private pay-only facilities. We would like the authority to collect the data from the 11 facilities that are affected by this, as well as conduct resident interviews as part of the consumer satisfaction quality of life feedback. There's also a budget request of $25,000 that would help us achieve the goal of having all Minnesota nursing homes available on the nursing home report card website.
Questions? Representative Loeffler.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And Assistant Commissioner, was there any thought, we definitely should be doing the veterans homes, but for those private pay or the nursing homes that have chosen that are not to accept our poorest residents who are on medical assistance, most of whom, if not all of them, I assume are for profit, was there any thought about an assessment to help pay for the cost of them being part of our information base for consumers?
Commissioner Coleman.
Mr. Chair, Representative Loeffler, I can't say there was no consideration, but that's not part of this page. We can revisit that. They do pay other fees through licensure and being able to participate in Minnesota as a nursing facility. So there are costs associated that are currently borne by them, but we can certainly consider that. That's not a consideration here. Most of the data that is currently required for the report card is already data that's collected. The money that is needed here, just so I'm clear, which isn't arguing the point of an assessment, is for that on-site interview process with consumers.
Does that complete your question?
Mr. Chair, it does.
Thank you, Commissioner. And I'm going to have to apologize to Deputy Commissioner Bronson and Assistant Commissioner Wilkin, both of whom, however, have had a lot of experience with this committee over the years. For those that don't know, Commissioner Wilkin was a member of this committee, and Deputy Commissioner Bronson was a staff person for this committee. So I apologize. We just don't have time. We'll have to reschedule. Both of you, I think we're filled up tomorrow, aren't we? So we'll reschedule to whatever's best for you too. And I apologize. With that, I'll adjourn the meeting.